Let me ask you to turn tonight to 1 Corinthians chapter 4, please. 1 Corinthians chapter 4. We've been looking at a series of passages in which the Apostle Paul, I believe, exposes to us the priorities or values of his life, that he had certain things that governed and controlled him and therefore directed the course of his life. The first was that his sense of service to Jesus Christ, his ministry, had a greater priority to him than the comforts and conveniences and, in fact, very continuance of his life. That he chose ministry over life. And then we turned, that was Acts 20, 24, then we turned to Philippians 1 to see that Paul wanted to glorify, exalt Christ, whether by life or by death. So the reason he would make that choice was because his consuming passion was to see Christ exalted. Because for him, life is Christ. And death is gain because he goes to be with Christ. So whether by life or by death, he wanted to exalt Christ, which meant if he was here, his life was Christ. If he went to be with the Lord, then that was gain because that's very much better. And the reason he could say that was what we saw last Sunday night in Philippians 3, that everything else that had mattered to him in his life, he counted as loss, in fact, could call it rubbish, so that he might know Christ, that he might have a knowledge of him, and the surpassing value of the knowledge of him, so that he could have not just his justification being found in the righteousness of Christ, but also in the process of his life, that he would come to know Christ in the power of his resurrection, the fellowship of his suffering, so that ultimately he could attain to glorification, the resurrection from the dead. So everything about Paul's life was focused on the fact that he wanted to know him, and the path to knowing him was a path that would lead through difficulty, and therefore he was willing to embrace it because of the surpassing value of knowing Christ. We do a little bit of a turn, but it's still a comparison. And the weaving thread through all these texts is that Paul does some kind of a statement of comparison. That is, I don't count my life as dear so that I might finish my course. That to live is Christ, to die is gain, because that's very much better. That is, there's some kind of comparison going on. He counted something as loss for the surpassing value of knowing Christ. So Paul's saying, you've got one thing here and another thing here. Let me tell you which is most important. Here's the priority. And that's what we're walking through. Now, he's going to do the same thing, only it's in a little different of context, but I think it's an essential part of how you and I could come to live like Paul lived and to serve Christ like Paul did. Look beginning in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 1. We'll be down to verse 5. Let a man regard us in this manner as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. In this case, moreover, it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. But to me, it is a very small thing that I may be examined by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even examine myself, for I am conscious of nothing against myself, yet I am not by this acquitted. But the one who examines me is the Lord. Therefore, do not go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts, and then each man's praise will come to him from God. Now, you can see, I think, I tried to read it with that emphasis. Verse 3, it says, but to me it is a very small thing. So here again, Paul is making a statement of comparative value. And one thing here says is very small. And so we'll get into what he's making the comparison on. But let me just set the backdrop for you. Paul planted the church at Corinth. It was a church at which there seemed to be always a bit of tension. Paul has heard about some things at the church, so he's writing back to them. And in the first part of the book, he's really confronting them about some wrong attitudes and thinking on their part. Then in the bulk of the book, after this opening section, really the first four chapters, he starts to answer questions about things. He deals with church discipline problems, some areas, and then he starts in 7 answering questions, not concerning the thing that you wrote to me about. And so he's responding to them. But in this first part of the book, really from chapter 1 into chapter 4, the focal point has been their divisive, the problems in the congregation. That they were not unified, particularly in some sense, about the true nature of the preaching of the cross. And that's what he deals with in the first 2 chapters. But a part of what's come to be in that, which he mentions in chapter 1 and then again in chapter 3, and he's going to deal with in chapter 4, is that the congregation has seemed to divide up into factions. And there are little slogans being used. I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Cephas or Peter, and the really spiritual ones, I'm of Christ. And they're divided in that, and one of the ways in which Paul begins to address them about it is to show them that kind of thinking misunderstands the nature of what these servants are. And that's what chapter 3 does in large measure, is to say, you know, who's Paul and Apollos? They're just servants. It's the Lord's work. He says to them, you are God's field. You are God's building. Paul and Apollos are just servants who are doing God's work. And then he talks about how servants should work, building with gold, silver, and precious stones instead of wood, hay, and stubble, because somebody has come into the congregation and is trying to urge them to go in a wood, hay, stubble kind of way. And Paul's saying, don't do that. Now, and we come right up to where we are, and that is, here's the tension that I think Paul now begins to address. In chapter 3, he says, we're just servants. And one problem that could come up because of that is that people might start to say, well, then if you're servants, do what we tell you to do. And that's what Paul's beginning to address here in chapter 4. He's now going to say, we're servants, but remember whose servants we are. We are the servants of Christ. And there were people who were judging Paul's ministry, apparently quite harshly. And Paul is going to tell them that in the balance of life, what they think of him is a very small thing compared to what the Lord will examine him about. And in doing so, Paul, I think, really does touch at what I think can be a universal problem. It's certainly a significant problem. That if we're truly going to serve Jesus Christ properly, then we have to come to have a priority structure in our lives where the opinions of people have a definite place below God's. That is, we cannot live allowing ourselves to think that the court that matters most is the court of human opinion. The court that matters most is the court of divine opinion and judgment. And that's what Paul's talking about here in the first 5 verses of this chapter. The way he moves into this in verses 1 and 2 is to teach two principles about the nature of ministry for Christ. And I'll just cover them fairly quickly so we can move into the point that or the central part of the passage I want us to. But in verse 1, he tells us about the nature of Christian ministry. He says, "Let a man regard us in this manner as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God." That "regard us" is this. He's basically saying, here's how you ought to think about us. This is the way you ought to think. When you think about us like this. Regard us this way. And he says that our position is as servants of Christ. We are those who serve a superior, Christ. We're under a master, Christ, and we are servants to him. Then look at the second description that he has, which I think in some sense talks about their responsibility. We are stewards of the mystery of God. He uses a term that if you're, if you read the New Testament, you become familiar with, because in the Gospels, for instance, you have these stories, parables of stewards, that is a master owned a certain piece of property, and he goes away to another area, and he puts somebody in charge of it. That's the steward. There, in some senses, it's the equivalent of what we would call a manager. You have an owner, and then you have a manager. The manager is the one who's supposed to oversee what's going on, to manage it in a way that's consistent and appropriate for what the owner wants to do. The manager can't act like the owner. The manager's the manager. That was a biblical steward. And so Paul says, here's how you ought to think about us. We are stewards. We have been entrusted with something by God, and we have to manage it. We have to be stewards of it in that regard. So what has he been entrusted with? Verse 1 says, stewards of the mysteries of God. The idea in our language of mystery is something that's secretive or hidden, but that's not really the idea here. The idea is something that had been hidden and now has been revealed. For instance, Paul talks about the church in Ephesians 3 as having been a mystery. That is, in the Old Testament, it wasn't clearly revealed. And now, with the return of Christ to heaven, the bestowal of the gift of the Spirit at Pentecost, and now we're in this era, this time period where God is calling into one body, Jews and Gentiles. That's the church. He calls that the mystery. It's something now that God has revealed to us. And so Paul is saying here that those who serve Christ in the capacity that he's in, and I think he's talking broader than apostle, because Apollos is in this equation. In fact, you can see that verse 6. "Now these things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos." So he's not just talking about apostles. He's talking about people who have a responsibility to proclaim and teach the mysteries of God. They're stewards of them. They are responsible to guard the deposit, to hold it in such a way that they can give an account to the master. Now that then leads us to verse 2, what the standard for that ministry is. And this is, as he's making his way to his main point, he says this in verse 2, "In this case, moreover, it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy or faithful." The idea is pretty simple. The Lord has gone to heaven. He has given gifts to men. And with those gifts come an obligation. And the standard for that is trustworthiness, faithfulness, fidelity. It is not the way that the Corinthians were thinking about it. They seem to be very contemporary in our mind way, because their argument was, hey, if we can shave a little bit of the edges off this message of the cross, it'll be more effective, because it's a stumbling block to the Jews, it's moronic to the Greeks. Let's polish it up a little bit. It'll be more effective. He has to say in the second book, we're not like those who market or peddle the Word of God. They wanted to make the gospel and its message, the mysteries of God, more acceptable to the pagan mind. And the only reason you would do that is for apparent success. That is, think about it this way. I mean, I always tend to operate on the things that I would buy. So, if you make a hamburger, okay, and you want to sell lots of them, you find ways to make it attractive to the buyers. You don't tell them this is the highest fat producing burger on the market. This is a heart attack between two pieces of bread. I mean, that's not the way you promote it. You promote it in a way that will make it attractive to the buyer so that the buyer will take it. And that's what they wanted. The problem is, and this is a terrible analogy to say at this point, but the burger is not ours to do that with. And that's what Paul's saying. We have, if I can put it this way, a product, the mysteries of God, that we have no right to tamper with. And really, the standard that we're going to be gauged by is not how many we sell. It's not going to be how broadly accepted it is. The standard, he's saying in verse 2, is, have we been faithful to the one who gave us that? That's the standard. Because honestly, at the end of the day, how many people accept it is outside of your control anyway. You can't make anybody truly come to Christ. Only God can do that. So you are not obligated in the whole scheme of things to have your main concern be there. Your main concern is toward the Master who entrusted it to you. That's the principle that Paul teaches them about the standard for ministry. So what is ministry? It's being a servant and being a steward. And what's the standard for servants and stewards? It's faithfulness. That then leads him to deal with the problem at Corinth. And he does that in verses 3 and 4. And he does it in a way that he's actually issuing a defense of himself with regard to what they were doing. They were passing judgment on him, and he wants them to understand. I mean, we always hear 1 and 2, and it's real positive. You know, it's required in stewards of man be found faithful. And what Paul's saying is, so since that's the case, here's what you need to know. It really doesn't matter to me what you think about me. It really doesn't matter to me what I think about me. Because what you think about me and what I think about me is really insignificant and inconclusive. What matters is what God thinks, because God really knows. That's what he's really saying here. So let's walk through that. Look at verse 3. Here's the insignificance of human examination. But to me, it is a very small thing that I may be examined by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even examine myself. I mean, Paul gets a pass on this because he's an apostle and it's scripture. But I can even sense when I said in a minute, it really doesn't matter what you think. You know, we automatically can start to think that that's some kind of arrogance or some kind of cockiness on Paul's part in which he thinks he's too important. But that's not it at all. It's really in the context of the principles of verses 1 and 2. That is, whose servant am I? Paul would be saying. I'm the servant of Christ and the steward of the mysteries of God. And I'm going to be held to a standard of faithfulness to God. So when I look at what you're concluding about me, what does it matter? You're not God. Your evaluation, Paul is saying, is of little consequence because it's God's evaluation that really matters. Now, I think we can safely say here. Well, let's just look at the text and then I'll safely say what I'm going to say. All right. He says in verse 3, examined by you, that is the Corinthians, and then he opens it up a little bit, or by any human court. And the idea there is probably something like we say, I want to have my day in court. That is, I want to have a chance to be able to step up and handle that examination in court because of that evaluation. So Paul's using that kind of a language, and he says, listen, in terms of you, the believers at Corinth, that he's praised in chapter 1, and he's talked positively about, and he's rebuked them now in chapters 1 and 2 and 3, he says, listen, it's a little thing for you to judge me, or any human court. It doesn't matter who it is, if it's flesh and blood in that regard. The point is that it's not the final call. And just to make sure they understand that he's not just talking about them, he says in verse 3, in fact, I do not even examine myself. Now, this is where I've got to make sure we're clear on it. First clarifying statement would be, again, Paul is talking about a comparison. He obviously cares about his relationship to them, doesn't he? I mean, he'll say in the second book, can't you open your heart up to me as I have opened mine up to you? Paul wants a good relationship with the Corinthians. He's not here saying, you guys are idiots and I could care less what you think. That's not his point. So don't think here he's showing disregard for them personally. He loves them and is pouring out his life for them and would love to have a good relationship with them. But he will not let them usurp the place of God. It doesn't matter how much he loves them and how much he wants to have a good relationship with them, they are not his master. So he will not allow himself to become their servant in that way. He must serve Christ. And therefore, he's making the appeal in that. The second clarification I think we need to make here is that when Paul says, I do not even examine myself, he is not saying that I never look at myself to evaluate my actions or behaviors or to engage in the process of reflective thinking about the course of my life. That's not the point about it, because he actually can tell the Corinthians at the end of the second book, examine yourselves to see if you be in the faith. Okay, he is not against that kind of examination. That's not his point. His point is not think about what you're doing and make sure it's the right thing. His point is, I am not the judge with regard to myself. Think about it this way. When Paul stands at the Bema seat before the judgment seat of Christ, he's not going to say, okay, now, Lord, could you move aside so I can come around here and I can judge myself? Paul's saying, I'm not my own judge in that regard. There's only one who can judge me. And that's what he says then very clearly at the end of verse 4. But the one who examines me is the Lord. So his point is to say that I am not, because I also am human, and we'll see in a moment, therefore not infallible, even I am not a sufficient or significant enough judge for myself. It's the Lord that must judge us. And so he's trying to make sure that we understand that human examination is ultimately insignificant, whether that comes from some congregation like the Corinthians or any human court or from ourselves. You know, if you stand here and tell me I pass the test, then I would say, well, I'm glad you think that. But you know what? You're not the one who's going to make that judgment. It's the Lord who will make that judgment. And so we have to recognize that. Now look at then in verse 4, because he has to qualify that, I think, because automatically raises the question. What do you mean you don't examine yourself? And so he talks here in verse 4 in what I would describe as the inconclusiveness of self-examination. Verse 4, "For I am conscious of nothing against myself, yet I am not by this acquitted." Now, and here, if you get the flow, remember this is a letter, all right? He's writing a letter. He's writing a letter to a church in which there's some tension. And it's almost as if he says this, "I do not even examine myself," and then thinks, I know somebody out there is going to say, "Well, Paul, if you did, you'd realize you have problems." And so his next words are, "But I don't know anything against myself. I'm not conscious of anything that I've done wrong." Okay, so he's saying, now I'm not saying that as a cloak to get away with everything. Okay, so he's not saying, I don't judge myself so that he can just do whatever he wants to do. He says, I don't judge myself because I'm not the judge. The Lord's the judge. But as I stand here right now, Paul says, I am conscious of nothing against myself. He can say with a clean conscience that he, as far as he knows, is living in obedience to God. There's no undealt with matter of sin. I am conscious of nothing against myself. And the idea of it really is how your conscience operates, you know? You do or say or think something, and your conscience sits in judgment on you. As your conscience goes, bah, you sinned. It either condemns or confirms, Romans says. It accuses or excuses. The conscience just does that based on what we do. And Paul says right now, he says, I am conscious of nothing against myself. And we think, man, that's great. But then look what he says, verse 4. Yet I am not by this acquitted. In essence, he says, you know, so my conscience doesn't tell me I've done anything wrong, but you know what? That doesn't mean that I'm acquitted. Why? Because his conscience isn't the final judge. I think what we have to understand here is that down below this is Paul's recognition of the reality of depravity. Jeremiah says, the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I hope you recognize, but I think in our day we've lost this, so I don't want to assume it, that just because your conscience doesn't bother you doesn't mean that you're not sinning. Your conscience could be messed up. You could have deceived yourself into thinking you didn't do anything wrong when in fact you did. Your conscience could have been twisted by bad education to it. I mean, and it's a complex study to look at Paul's statements about his conscience, but you know what? He could say, having been a part of putting Stephen to death, that he served his God with a good conscience from his youth. I mean, he was acting according to a standard that was woven into him that was flawed. But he was doing it in good conscience. In fact, he says in the Scriptures, I was shown mercy because I did it ignorantly. So the fact is that you could say, hey, my conscience doesn't bother me, doesn't mean you win. The point for Paul is I'm not going to be able to stand at the judgment seat of Christ and say, you know, my conscience said this was okay. And Jesus, oh, well, if that's the case, then you're all right. But that's what we've been told in our day. I remember years ago now, when I was a youth pastor, I'd gone to lunch with another youth pastor in the area who, we had known each other for a long time from college, and we happened to get back right at the start of the class. I taught a Bible class, actually a couple at the time, but one of the ones I was teaching, and we walked in, and he walked in, and he'd been in chapel, so they all started asking questions. Well, somebody had preached in chapel on a controversial subject, and so you know, they're all buzzing about the subject and they're asking questions. So we get into a discussion. The two of us are at the front and we're going back and forth with the thing. And then he says, have you prayed about, you know, what you're wrestling with? Yes. Does your conscience bother you? No. Well, then don't worry about it. And I'm looking over and going, you turkey. I mean, I didn't say it, but I had to say, you know what? I disagree with what he just said there. Because, and I went right to this text, that your conscience can be wrong. The standard for your behavior is not your conscience. Your standard for your behavior is the Scriptures. Your conscience is not Lord. Christ is. And you better not just accept the misguided statements of our day that sort of say, well, you know, if you're not bothered by it, then it's okay. That's not the route. Now, certainly you shouldn't sin against your conscience, and you should be working hard to have your conscience informed by the Scriptures. And we don't want to, we saw in Romans 14, you don't want to sin against your conscience, but don't make the mistake of putting your conscience in the pilot seat. Okay? Because if Paul didn't trust his, I'm not going to trust mine. His conscience knew nothing against himself, yet by this he was not acquitted before God. It wasn't conclusive. And that's his point across the board. You know why it's insignificant that the Corinthians or any human court or he himself would judge himself? Because ultimately no human can do it the right way. They cannot ultimately see things with the clarity that only God can see things. And that's what Paul leads to then. And look at the end of verse 4. But the one who examines me is the Lord. Therefore, do not go on passing judgment before the time. And here he comes into the searching nature of the judgment. But wait until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts, and then each man's praise will come to him from God. What Paul says to them ultimately, and the point of it is, he says, all right, now here's the principles. We're God's servants, and we must strive to be faithful. And in fact, because of that, you know, what you think or any court thinks or even what I think doesn't matter, only what the Lord thinks. So stop passing this kind of judgment. Because there is an appointed examination. The Lord will judge us when He comes. It's certain. When Jesus comes back, there will be a judgment. We must all appear, he says in the second book of Corinthians, before the judgment seat of Christ. Okay? There will be a day of judgment in which Jesus Christ will evaluate His servants. And it's key to understand that. Paul's talking here about those who know Christ. Everyone who knows Christ will be judged by Christ, not about their eternal destiny, but about their service for Christ. Have they been trustworthy? Have they, to use the language of Peter, been a good steward of the manifold grace of God? Have they served Christ in a way that is His will? That judgment will come. And therefore, every believer must live in light of that judgment. And here's the point of Paul's priority structure. What he's saying to these Corinthians is, I love you. I am laying out my life for you. I want you to love me. He says, 2 Corinthians 12:15, the more I love, the less I be loved. He wants them to care about Him. He wants to, he'll say later in the same chapter, to have a relationship with them like a father with children through the gospel. But he says this, you will not be on the judgment seat of Christ. Jesus will. And I know that there's a day, Paul's saying, when I'm going to stand before Jesus Christ And if it comes down to choosing to hear him say, you've been a trustworthy servant, or having your affection and commitment, there's no choice for me. Being found faithful is more important than being found acceptable to you. Being found trustworthy is more important to me than having you like me. There's an appointed judgment, and we have to come to recognize that, because one of the greatest threats constantly to believers is that they have a sense of what God wants them to do, and when they start to do it, they meet with disapproval by people. They bend and turn back. They cater to the pressure of people around them. They start to think, if I really sell out and serve Jesus Christ, then people will talk about me or say this thing or think this thing or do this thing. And at that point, they're saying, what you think about me means more than what Jesus thinks about me. And that's a prescription for a failed life of service to Christ. It doesn't matter at the Bema seat, at the judgment seat, what those other people think. They're not the judge. Jesus is. And in fact, look at the kind of, there's a certain appointed judgment, and it will ultimately be an accurate judgment. He says here, but until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the things hidden in darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts. Now, let me just say this. On one hand, that's a scary thing, isn't it? But I don't think Paul intends it to be a scary thing for us, really. I think you have to think of context. It can be. But here's what Paul's saying, all right? In the context of it is, you're passing a harsh judgment on me. God knows what's right. The Lord knows the interior of my life. Everything about it will come to light. And look at the end of verse 5. And each man's praise will come to him from God. You know what Paul's really saying, and it ought to search us, if we're of mixed motive, if we're doing things to be seen by people, it ought to search us. But this isn't the primary intent of the text. Go to Matthew 6 for something like that, where he says, don't do your righteousness to be seen of men, because then you'll have it in full. I think here it is this. Is ultimately, I may live, Paul is saying, I may live under your judgment of disapproval. But there's coming a day when Jesus Christ, who sees everything perfectly, his light will shine and it will open up everything, and Jesus knows what's right. So I'll trust him. The reason I say this, that's very similar to what Jesus himself had to do. Peter tells us that when he was being reviled, he did not revile again. But what did he do? He entrusted himself to him who judges righteously. Jesus was having all of this scorn and mocking heaped upon him. And he took it. He took it to do what his mission was, and basically said, Father, you judge righteously. I'm going to leave it in your hands. You know what's right. I'm going to trust you. And that's exactly what Paul's saying here. He's saying, hey, you know, you can judge me, but it's a small thing. My own judgment is minuscule. It doesn't matter. Jesus is going to be the judge. And that day is going to get here, and it's going to be accurate. And I'll hear Jesus say, well done, thou good and faithful servant. And you know, at that point, I think Paul would say, if he was elaborating on it, at that point, I may still wish that you had responded properly, but it'll be a passing wish, hearing from Christ, well done. Good and faithful servant. He won't lose an ounce of sleep in eternity over it. Because what really matters is what Christ thinks. What really matters is the day of judgment, not the day of service. It's a little unclear right now. And in fact, there's all kinds of servants who are being faithful to God that nobody sees. But Jesus does. And they don't see, there's people who are being judged in a small window and sometimes being judged harshly about it. But Jesus doesn't look through any small window. He sees the whole thing. And at that day, there'll be no regrets because Jesus knows. And that's what matters to Paul. Let's bow together in prayer. Lord, please help us to have the kind of clarity about this that Paul had. Because we live in a world and we struggle with the flesh that call us to want to make a name or have approval or gain position. We even give it fancy names like positive self-acceptance and getting regard from people as the key to our own health. And in many ways, actually turn from what the scriptures say. That it doesn't really matter in the big picture. What matters is the day of judgment before you. So help us to live like that. Help us to make our choices in life like that. Help us to serve like that. Help us as a church to be committed to the gospel and your word like that. The fitting in is not our agenda. Being faithful is. Lord, please give us the courage of heart and conviction that we need in a day like ours so that we might be faithful to you. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.